Welcome to the second day of our Omaha panel for November. I'm Mike Pirtle, Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals, and I'm pleased to be joined today on my right by Judge Francie Reedman and on my left by Judge Larry Welch. We have three cases this morning. We're going to take them in the order they are listed. Since we are not in our courtroom in the Capitol in Lincoln, these are being audio recorded only. And they will be available on the Supreme Court website several days from now for your review if interested. Again, if there's anything of a confidential nature, just keep that in mind. Maybe use a first name instead of a full name while arguing. The other thing is we will ask you to leave your mask on while you're in the courtroom, but when you come to deliver your oral argument, please take off your mask and then place it back on once the argument is over. So with that, we will begin. And our first case is In Re Interest of Destiny H. Counsel may approach. Good morning, Ms. White.
Good morning, Your Honors.
You may proceed.
May it please the Court. My name is Riley White. I'm an assistant public defender from Douglas County, appearing on behalf of the appellant, Amber McCreary. At this time, I'd like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal.
You may remove your mask if you'd like.
Oh, thank you. Your Honors, Ms. McCreary, the appellant in this case, entered an adjudication in juvenile court for a no-fault mental health case. The removal of her children was based on the need for mental illness, but she was no longer able to provide the care for them at the time of their removal in 2019. Since the inception of this case, Ms. McCreary engaged with caseworkers and services to address her mental health concerns, as well as housing and meaningful visits with her children. It is difficult to address this case without acknowledging the impact of the pandemic that this had on her ability to reunify with her children. Now, in juvenile court, the services that are implemented are supposed to be geared towards giving parents a meaningful opportunity towards reunification, as well as addressing the barriers that lead to juvenile court involvement. In a no-fault mental health case, while all orders and services are important, it's important to consider the impact of meaningful services to address the underlying mental health needs and provide stability to a family. In this case, the services that allowed Ms. McCreary to interact with her children, such as visitation, were essentially eradicated for months at a time. The opportunity to engage in meaningful visits with her children was reduced to teleconference calls with minor children. The caseworker acknowledged that in nowhere compares to meaningful in-person visits. How do you measure a parent's ability to interact with their children appropriately over a conference line? How do you look at or establish a bond when there's a poor connection and noise in the background? And you can't be in any sort of environment that's a natural reflection of your ability to care for your children.
Was the disruption in the visitation caused solely by the pandemic, or was there something having to do with the fact that the foster parent, if you will, was her mother, and there was apparently some tension in that relationship?
I'm glad that was addressed, because in any sort of case, there's obviously going to be the natural sort of parenting skills that do need to be addressed, and those are going to be barriers that are internal and things that she needs to work on with family support workers. But beyond that, there were the external barriers, such as her relationship with her mother, who, as you noted, there was tension in their relationship to the extent that Ms. Sides, one of the visitation workers, was continually reaching out to caseworkers, asking whether she could impede visits and obstruct the location of them and demand her presence at those. That was something that played into their ability to have an increased number of visits where potentially she could have otherwise hosted them in a kinship home when a lot of external facilities such as Heartland Family Services were closed to the public.
Was there much in the record? We have four children here.
Yes.
And it appears Diana, who was born in 2013, had been for a long time living with a paternal aunt, I believe.
Yes, I was not the council record for the child club, so it's not clear to me whether that was formally established as a guardianship with the aunt, but the general structure had been that she had been residing with that aunt since she was born. And so that is something as well that's important to note, although there was testimony from Ms. Peaks and Ms. Sides, who's the visitation worker for three of the children, the record is devoid of almost any information pertaining to the interactions with Diana. It appears Ms. Stark, the aunt, did supervise some of those, but it was all secondhand hearsay information as to the appropriateness of those visits and the extent or amount.
That's another thing that I was bothered by in the record, that it appeared that early on the goal in this matter was reunification with the three children and guardianship for Diana, but then at some point down the road before the permanency hearing, somehow this got changed for reunification for all four, and I don't see an explanation in the record for that.
And in reviewing the record, there is some confusion just to the extent that it did change judges as well. So certain orders and things that were referred to as review and permanency or continued dispositional hearings, I do think that added to some of the murkiness in the record that at what point exactly what the reunification status was with each of the children and the orders in place. I think it's important to note that when the caseworker testified, she was not even aware this was brought in as a no-fault mental health case. And while it's natural that cases are going to transition between judges or attorneys, specifically stated I was not the attorney of record for the trial, but even so, in reviewing it, there was an absence of an internal consistency where even the case managers who theoretically should be putting services geared towards reunification and addressing mental health, when they lose sight of what brought them into juvenile court, how can they say that reasonable efforts to address the conditions leading to adjudication were achieved when they're not aware of what conditions brought them into juvenile court?
And excuse me, weren't there three different judges involved in this case?
I believe it started out with Judge Kelly and then perhaps Judge Daniels when it was being reassigned. That was just something I noted. The trial did end with Judge Shuckman. So in reviewing the orders, that's where I often noted as well who was signing those to see if that could amount or account for some of the inconsistencies or clarities, just the labeling of what each hearing was.
Are we able to tell from the record how long the mother was without medication?
Based on the review of the record, there's at least a period of 9 months where they believe she was without medication, given her inability, or she wasn't eligible for Medicaid at one point. And in fact, Ms. Sides did testify that they believed that the reason she wasn't taking medication for the duration of the case was because she could not afford it. What was frustrating as well is although St. Francis made referrals for services to try to pay for medication, they even acknowledged that those services or referrals they were able to maybe pay for it 1 or 2 months at a time. And that, I think, goes to the broader point of this case, which is in looking at the terms of a rehabilitation plan or parents' noncompliance, I just argue that not all orders are created equally. There's parenting courses, there's things they can engage in, and you're supposed to complete all of the orders, of course. But if you have something like medication, it's impossible to separate how much more effectively the rest of those orders could have been carried out had she had the stability of medication. There's a lot of concerns as to her erratic behavior, mention of a ticket to Hawaii. These are things that the juvenile court did strike testimony as to speculation that she may have been inebriated. Really, more logically, look at some of those behaviors, and that's a mental health crisis. Those are the sort of bizarre erratic behaviors that could have been very well related to her being off medications, and with more stability and consistency in those, I think it would have allowed for her to make more meaningful progression on other orders.
Are we able to separate out her participation, if you will, in the services when she was on medication versus when she was not on medication?
I believe, and again, this is one of the difficulties with some of the visits and things being held over at conference calls. You don't have those sort of in-person interactions, which could often fill in the gaps as to her day-to-day behaviors. But if you do see the engagement with caseworkers, she might drop off in communication. However, there is no doubt that she was bonded with her children. I think the fact that she did, in fact, seek treatment indicates her willingness and her desire to seek help for her mental health. She has a nursing degree. She's an educated mother, and you know, this is, I'd also note that the children were placed in a kinship placement. So some of these questions, while there is a timeline and children are not meant to spend in the foster care system forever, this is one of the cases that I believe should deviate from the normal timeline, because it's worth taking the time to see what would be possible with meaningful access to medication.
Didn't the court order St. Francis to pay for the medication, and then the St. Francis worker said they were out of money or they couldn't afford it?
Essentially, yes, it said it just didn't exist. And so that sort of service, in some sense, if that medication management was going to be a court order, in theory, there should at least be the opportunity to avail ourselves of that service. And in essence, that order for medication management existed on paper alone, not in effect.
Okay. I see you're into your rebuttal time. Do you want to go ahead and
reserve the rest of that? If there's no more questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Barnhill.
Good morning, Judge. Good morning, and may it please the court and counsel. My name is Nathan Barnhill. I am the Deputy County Attorney from Douglas County, and I am here on behalf of the appellee, the state of Nebraska, and I'm here today to ask the court to affirm the lower court's ruling terminating the appellant's parental rights. I believe a review of the record shows this case to be very similar to the factual pattern in In Re Interest of BB, which is 239 Nebraska, 952.
Is that a case in which was a mental health case and the provider who was ordered to provide the medication failed to do so?
No, Judge, but it deals with the mother attending services, therapy, as well as parenting classes to address the basis of the removal. However, in that case, the court was able to clearly see a complete lack of insight on behalf of the mother. She reverted to all of her old patterns, her same behaviors, and was not able to put any of the children's needs above her own wants and needs. And I think that's what we can see here, where the mother did complete treatment and very early on in the case. However, we never saw any follow-through on aftercare. There was a medication issue, I will concede on that, but that was only for 9 months out of the case, and by the time of the final termination hearing, we were at 22.
Wasn't the 9 month speculation? Nobody really knew for sure how long that had been going on.
It was, yes, Judge, but I think everyone was in agreement that the mother was medicated at some point, and I think...
And didn't the court order her to get her medication?
Yes.
So what was the problem with St. Francis not providing it?
I can't speak to St. Francis' policies and procedures. I know that efforts were made to refer to community resources, which could have helped the mother. I think Douglas County Health Department was referenced, Lutheran Family Services, where she did receive a short-term supply. And then I think once she got back on Medicare is when she was able to get her medication. And from that point forward, I believe she was compliant with the medication management.
Are you able to point in the record to periods where she was on medication and failed to do her visitation, attend counseling, anything where she was non-compliant?
Not specifically, or not directly, but my reading of the orders in the record indicate that in late 2019 is when Judge Daniels issued an order referring her to legal aid to help with her SSI disability and Medicare. And from that point forward, I believe in early 2020 is when she began receiving her medication, I believe through the Nebraska Psychiatric Associates or Sleep Clinic. I think we heard testimony from Sarah Crone, the caseworker, that even after that point, she still saw no increase in engagement. The mother still was displaying erratic behaviors. She was showing up in the middle of the night at the foster parent's home, holding a knife, talking about her juice going missing. I think medication, however concerning, I don't think that's dispositive of the mother's ability to care for her children. I think even when she was medicated, we still see the same patterns. And so, and I just think it's just a complete lack of insight and follow through. Even when she's medicated, she still didn't complete the treatments, the aftercare. I don't think the medication is what this case should hinge on.
How did the permanency objective for Deanna get changed from guardianship to reunification?
I think that may have been a change in the judges. I think we had a couple, as the court noted, a couple judges on this case to do some changes on the bench. From the onset of this case, the primary objective for Diana was guardianship because Diana had never lived with her mother, essentially. Early on in the case, the mother told the caseworker that she had no interest in reunifying with Diana. She was perfectly happy where she was. So I think that displays the primary objective early on, and then I think as the case progressed, with the judges changing over, it may have gotten switched.
So would you agree that there shouldn't have been a termination of parental rights as to Diana in this case?
No, I believe a termination of parental rights was still appropriate. I think even though the primary objective was reunification, I think at the time of the termination, the adoption was an appropriate objective.
Doesn't there have to be some notice to the parent that the permanency objective is being changed on that child prior to the termination hearing?
I believe there was a concurrent objective entered in some order. I may be mistaken, but I as far as notice, I think notice is just the time frame. The case has been open so long, the child has been out of the mother's life and home for so long, I think that provides a notice to a parent that termination is on the table.
I also find this record to be extremely inadequate as to the best interests of the children. Everything seems to be focused on the mother, and there's hardly anything about how the children are doing and what's best going forward.
I think there was testimony, Judge, about the children's desire to be with the mother. I think Ms. Sides and Ms. Crone both testified that the older children would routinely cancel visits with their mother. On visits where the mother would cancel, I believe Destiny, the oldest at one point, said, well, this is the way it is. And I think that demonstrates the lack of bond between the mother and the children that supports a termination in their best interest. And also, the court can look at the mother's actions on the children, the missing visits, the efforts that Ms. Sides made, the appointments at Children's Museum that she just didn't show up to, that, you know, she would, the teleconference calls, you know, COVID affected us all, and we had to do with what we had to do. But she only answered twice out of the four calls. You know, the call would ring and ring and ring, and then the children were left on the phone with nothing to do. And the two times she did answer, she was with people. She was not able to separate herself from a situation in which she could hear her children or engage with their children.
Did her relationship with her mother have some things to do with this?
I think in any situation with a kinship placement, there's going to be that familial tension. There was a period of time where the grandmother was not willing to have visits at her home. That was due to COVID. I think the record reflected that the mother was very ill for a period of time, and the grandmother and foster parent had underlying health concerns and was at high risk, and COVID could have been very, very dangerous for her. She did just, you know, the mother was told that, you know, we just need a negative test. And she was provided testing clinics, testing locations by Ms. Sides, but she just could never find the time to do it.
Did the mother have authority, the grandmother have authority to regulate whether visitations were happening or not?
No, Your Honor. That rests with the court. But again, I think that was such a short period of time. It's not dispositive or fatal to the state's case. I think even we have a mother who's, since almost the inception of the case, she was provided more visits. I think she was up to three a week at the start, but then she asked them to be reduced because she found them boring and overwhelming, and by her own admission, she couldn't handle her own children. And from basically the beginning on, we were at one visit a week for 2 hours. And during, you know, that's not enough time to build a meaningful bond between parents and children. And also she never even asked for more visits either, even after she became medicated at whatever point. If we, you know, assume that's in early 2020, we still have a period of time where she never asked for more visits. And her attendance was still sporadic, her engagement was low, and so I don't think that's a dispositive issue.
Wasn't it in the record that one of the obstacles to the guardianship for Diana was the birth father had not initially been willing to terminate his parental rights, but before the termination or permanency hearing, both parents had indicated their willingness to allow the guardianship to go forward. Both parents were willing to sign whatever documents so they could voluntarily do that.
That's correct, Judge.
Why didn't that happen?
I think, I believe at that point that the termination was already filed and the state was ready to proceed. And with all these, there's a deadline, a statutory deadline on these filings. And to come to the hearing and say, oh, well, I want to relinquish, I think that could cause undue delay. These parents were not entirely reliable. The record was also reflected that Ms. Crone's ability to sometimes get in contact with the mother was very strained. There were periods of time where she had no communication. So the state felt that any sort of delay would be undue and unnecessary.
How was that in the best interest of Deanna?
Guardianship is not always a permanent option either. Guardianships can be undone, and it was the state's position that termination was more appropriate to completely sever the bond between parent and child and allow her to be adopted by her parent placement or anyone, just to provide her with that guaranteed permanency.
That's a tough sell. That really is.
And if there's no other questions, Judge, I would yield the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, just briefly, there was some discussion of the interaction with the younger children's on visits. And again, I would note that with the use of conference calls and through Ms. Side's own admission, the difficulties of redirecting children and the court-ordered plan of rehabilitation should not be left up to you and the younger children who are perhaps not engaged in visits with their mother because they didn't have meaningful access to visit her or develop that bond either. The circumstances which lead a parent into juvenile court warrant more than a 3-person teleconference call, particularly in a mental health case. And I see that I'm out of time.
Before you conclude, what's your position on the guardianship?
The position in the guardianship with respect to Diana, I apologize, your question with whether termination would be proper.
Right. Or is it your position that the guardianship should continue with her?
Yes. Specifically, we would ask that if the court were to find termination was improper, that it would either revert to a guardianship if that was, in fact, formally established, or at least submit a matter to inquiry with the juvenile court as to whether reunification or guardianship would be the permanency objective. But we would ask that it be reversed and remanded on the issue of termination for all 4 children.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you both for being here. We will take the case under advisement and you're excused.